This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our guest, Eagle Bud Krogh, was the first official of the Nixon administration to plead guilty to crimes associated with the Watergate scandal. While working at the White House in 1971, Krogh headed the secret investigative unit that was known as the Plumbers because they were supposed to stop leaks of sensitive information. While Krogh was in charge, the Plumbers broke into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist, Dr. Lawrence Fielding. This was after Ellsberg had leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. Krogh eventually pleaded guilty to conspiring to violate Dr. Fielding's rights. Krogh served 6 months in jail and was disbarred, though he later regained his law license and returned to practice in Seattle. Krogh says he's written about his experiences after more than 30 years because he believes officials in Washington today need to think more about their duty to the public and less about blind loyalty to their superiors. Daniel Ellsberg wrote a foreword to Krogh's book in which he says, "I would be glad if every public servant were to read and learn from this memoir." But Krogh's new book is called Integrity. He spoke with our frequent guest host, Dave Davies.
Well, Bud Krogh, welcome to Fresh Air. Tell us how you came to work at the Nixon White House.
Well, it came about because of really a long family friendship with John Ehrlichman and his family. After the election in 1968, John had served as tour director on that campaign. He came to Seattle, where I was working in his law firm at the time. I'd been there about 3 months since getting out of law school. He came into my office and he put his feet at my desk and said, "Well, do you like your work here?" And I said, "Yes, sir, I do." And he said, "Well, I've been appointed counsel to the president in the new administration, and would you consider leaving the law firm and coming to Washington, D.C. to be staff assistant to the counsel to the president?" Yes. That's about how long it took me from the question to say yes. And right after that meeting, he said, "You've got about 3 days." And 3 days later, I found myself in New York City, working in Richard Nixon's transition office in preparation for his new term, working out of the Hotel Pierre.
And soon you're at the White House at age 29. Heady stuff.
That's correct. It was pretty heady stuff. That's correct.
You'd done a tour in the Navy and law school, so you'd had some life experience under your belt. And I know that you worked on a number of different policy areas, including crime in the District of Columbia and the international drug trade. But in July of 71, John Ehrlichman calls you into the office and has a particularly sensitive assignment. What did he want you to do?
Well, he gave me a bucket file that had Pentagon Papers on the file, and he said, "The president is going to set up a special investigations unit to find out everything that we can find out about why the Pentagon Papers, which had been classified top secret, it was a history of the Vietnam War up through the Johnson administration, why those papers were released to the New York Times." He told me that the president viewed this as a matter of the highest national security importance. He told me that Dr. Henry Kissinger was going to assign David Young, one of his special assistants, to the unit to sort of be the co-director with me, and that I was to put that unit together right away. And Mr. Ehrlichman told me, he said, "We want you to pursue this with utmost zeal. This is something that the president feels very strongly about, and he would like you, before you get started, to read the first chapter in his book, Six Crises, on his investigation of Alger Hiss."
So you read the chapter on Alger Hiss, who was this State Department official who was convicted as a Soviet spy that Nixon had investigated. What did you make of Nixon's insisting that you read this chapter?
Well, I took from his assignment to read that chapter on Six Crises about Alger Hiss that we were to pursue this investigation as thoroughly and as comprehensively as we possibly could, as he had pursued the investigation of Alger Hiss, who subsequently was convicted for perjury. I also derived from reading that chapter that the president viewed the release of the Pentagon Papers as a national security crisis, as he had viewed his investigation of Alger Hiss as bearing directly on the nation's security. So I took both of those messages away from reading the chapter.
You know, one of the fascinating things about your story is that, I mean, you didn't get direct instructions from Nixon at this point, but because Nixon secretly recorded so many of his conversations and because the Watergate scandal revealed them to the public, you were able later to go back and review what Nixon himself said about this assignment.
That's right.
What did you learn?
Well, I went back afterwards and I read the transcripts and in some cases listened to the tapes of the actual conversations where he was describing how he wanted this investigation to go forward. And he said he wanted somebody who was, I think he would say, just as ruthless as he was, who was willing to set everything aside and focus on this directly. He also said that he wanted someone who was a real SOB. And I didn't know that he had said that at the time. I wasn't in the meetings where those words were used. And I always pondered later, you know, why me? Why would he pick me to be the head of that unit? And because he had other candidates on the White House staff who I think in retrospect were probably a lot more suited for that kind of assignment. I think he picked me in part because he knew I was very loyal to him and to John Ehrlichman. I was pretty diligent at the work that I did, and he felt that I would carry it out.
Now, this outfit was called the Special Investigations Unit. We now know it as the Plumbers, right?
So yes.
Those who fix leaks.
We got that name because David Young was talking with his mother-in-law. He was my co-director of the White House Plumbers, and she asked him what he was working on, and he said, well, you know, we're involved in plugging leaks here in the White House. And she said something, and I paraphrase, oh, how nice. Well, we have a carpenter in the family. Now we have a plumber. And he thought that was quite funny, and he made a little sign up that had plumbers on it and put it on the wall just to the right of our door in our office, and that's how we became known as the Plumbers.
So G. Gordon Liddy comes to work at the unit. Now, he is a legendary figure of Watergate. I mean, could you see the guy that we later came to know as Gordon Liddy in that early experience? I mean, he comes across as, you know, fanatically dedicated, ruthless. Did you see
yes,
him that way?
Yes, I did not. At the time that I hired Gordon, brought him to the White House, I saw him as a man who was a dedicated supporter of Richard Nixon, conservative in his views, that's true. But did not sense the ruthlessness or maybe even the sort of the fanatical intensity that he exhibited later on. I saw him as an extremely able person, a very good writer, by the way, who wrote some memoranda when he was on the White House Special Investigations Unit about the FBI that were classic, that were just viewed as right on in terms of describing the problems that the administration was having with the Bureau at the time. Those memoranda got to the president, who read them. And one of them, I know Ehrlichman called me up and said, well, that memorandum from Mr. Liddy came back with A pluses all over it. So I wasn't really aware, I think, of the potential for fanaticism that I think came out later.
My guest is Eagle Bud Crow. He has written a new book reflecting on the lessons of his experience in the Watergate scandal. It's called Integrity, Good People, Bad Choices, and Life Lessons from the White House. Now, there was the leak of the Pentagon Papers, which infuriated Nixon, and then there was another leak that involved a potential American proposal in strategic arms limitations talks with the Soviets that got printed in the New York Times that sent Nixon over the top. And, you know, your job in this unit, at that point it seemed, was to do arguably a legitimate government function, which is to figure out who was, you know, divulging, you know, official classified information improperly. Did you think at this point that you were going to be getting into anything illegal or improper?
No, I didn't. And there was a meeting with the president on July 24th, 1971, about that leak of the United States fallback position in the negotiations with the Soviets in the strategic arms limitation talks that were then going on in Helsinki. And I was in my office on a Saturday morning, and John Ehrlichman called me up and said, the president wants to see us immediately. Drop whatever you're doing and come on over. So I went over to the West Wing, and we walked into the Oval Office, and the president was pacing behind his chair and slamming his fist into his hand, and it looked about as angry as I'd ever seen him. And his concern was that this release of the fallback position in the SALT talks was going to jeopardize his ability to get a good deal for the United States in those negotiations. And I think it was a proper exercise of governmental authority to try to find out who was involved in that and try to stop those leaks from occurring in the future. So, and he conflated the salt leak investigation and the Pentagon Papers and said during that meeting that this is national security and this will not be allowed and we will just not allow it, and made me feel, to some degree, personally responsible for trying to find out why those leaks had occurred and to stop them from happening in the future.
So you said about arranging for polygraph examinations of various government officials who are suspected of perhaps having provided information to the media. But at some point, the notion of getting the confidential files of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist emerges. Where did that idea come from?
That idea about getting the information from Dr. Lewis Fielding, who was Dr. Ellsberg's psychiatrist, was proposed by E. Howard Hunt. And we had asked the CIA for a psychological profile on Dr. Ellsberg, which when it came back, I think all of us felt that it was very short and not very useful in telling us what the likelihood was that he would release other top-secret information if he had access to it. And so in that context, like, we need to know everything about this individual and also to get information that E. Howard Hunt was going to be using with Chuck Colson to use to discredit Dr. Ellsberg. Hunt did recommend that we carry out a covert operation. Now, I asked him what that meant, and they said, well, now we're talking to both E. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy. This will involve an entry operation into his office where we will photograph those records. But the idea originated with Howard Hunt.
So an entry operation. I love these antiseptic terms.
You know, you're exactly right on that, Dave, because you use the terms to mask what's really going on, which is you're recommending a burglary, maybe second degree under the laws of the state of California. In a way, by using terms that don't go directly at what you're doing, somehow you're camouflaging what your intent really is.
And it's interesting here that we're talking about getting information that it doesn't sound like it really has to do with stopping leaks as much as arguably a political mission, which is to discredit Ellsberg, who is an administration critic, right?
That's correct. And I think that's really one of the real fundamental flaws in the reasoning of that group, of the Plumbers group, is that they extended this idea of national security to include political security, because information that could be used to discredit Daniel Ellsberg arguably does not affect the national security. It might affect the ability of the president to continue to carry out his policies in Vietnam, to end the war in Vietnam on his terms. But that's a very tenuous relationship to the national security interest. But I don't believe at that time that that group, maybe even the president, really could make that clear a distinction between what was in a politically motivated and driven activity and that which was driven by a national security imperative. And that's the big problem, when you can't really be clear and distinguish those two.
Well, this does become a fateful moment in the story, because here you are, 31 years old, you're a trained lawyer, and someone's talking about an entry operation, which is a, you know, breaking and entering. At this point, did you think, you know, you were in charge of this unit along with this other official, David Young, did you think, we just can't do this? Is this improper? What was your thoughts on, what were you thinking of?
Well, in retrospect, I wished I had been able to see the full consequences of what we were doing, that this was something that could have a fatal effect on the administration if ever disclosed. But I was so hardwired into the mission to find out what was Ellsberg's motivation, why he did it, how can we stop this from happening in the future, were there other people involved? I did not stop to ask the legal question. And you would have thought, of those four people in the Special Investigations Unit, three of us were lawyers, had gone to go to law schools, that would have been the first thing we would have done. We didn't do that. We basically asked the sort of the practical questions, you know, who can do this? When can they do it? How much is it going to cost us to do it? You know, all the practical questions, but we didn't go to the legal question, is this legal, or do any analysis of that? We didn't ask the ethical question. We didn't ask any of the questions that real integrity would have required us to ask.
So at some point, this notion of breaking into the psychiatrist of Daniel Ellsberg, who had leaked the Pentagon Papers and was a thorn in Richard Nixon's side. This operation actually moved forward. Tell us about the actual break-in. I mean, you weren't there, but what did these gentlemen actually do?
Well, over the Labor Day weekend of 1971, E. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy, with a team of Cuban Americans with whom Mr. Hunt had worked during the Bay of Pigs and at other times when Mr. Hunt was a member of the CIA, they went to California. They went to Beverly Hills. They conducted a break-in. On the way into the building, they broke a window. So when they got into the building and went up to the floor where Dr. Fielding had his office, they did break into that office. They searched for the files with the expectation that they would be able to photograph those files. And then because the window had been broken, they decided on the spot to make it look as if somebody had broken in to steal drugs, and they pretty much trashed the office of Dr. Fielding, and then they took pictures of it. And they came back after the operation. They were relieved that obviously they were not caught. And in fact, Gordon Liddy called me to tell me that they had gotten out of the office without getting caught. And they came back to Washington, D.C., where they showed me the pictures of the damage that had been inflicted on the office, and I was just appalled. Because the exact instructions that we had given them was that this was to be a covert operation. In fact, in the memorandum to Mr. Ehrlichman in recommending this operation, we said we recommend that a covert operation be undertaken to examine all of the files still held by Dr. Ellsberg, a psychiatrist. And he had put his initial E after approval and underneath said, under your assurance, it is not traceable. And when I saw those photographs of what had been done in the office, I was extremely upset about it and took them over to show John Ehrlichman, who told me, he said, that's far beyond anything I authorized. Shut it down. And we did.
And one of the odd little details, they left some film in a camera, right, of Liddy and Hunt in California that ended up in the hands of the CIA, didn't they?
That's correct. They left a film in a camera that they had used out there in the CIA developed that film, which eventually found its way over to the Department of Justice and to the, I believe the Assistant Attorney General of the Criminal Division, who was sort of puzzled by what is this photograph of Gordon Liddy standing in front of a parking space with Dr. Fielding's name on it. And so there were a number of things that were done that suggested that perhaps the highest degree of competence might not have been in effect at the time.
He's standing in front of a parking space with the target's name on it.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, you know, it's interesting because when you think about Nixon's, you know, fist-pounding obsession with Ellsberg and his belief that he was a traitor on the order of Alger Hiss, you talked to him, you know, years after all this. Do you think he was ever – did he ever think he was wrong, or did he believe that Ellsberg was a conspirator who got away?
You mean did Nixon ever –
Nixon, yeah.
You know, I never felt that the president, President Nixon, felt that he was wrong about that. And, in fact, in his memoirs, RN, he did say that he thought it was a tragic miscarriage of justice that Daniel Ellsberg was released and that I went to prison. I don't think that is a miscarriage of justice. I mean, those of us who were involved obviously committed a serious crime, and the legal consequences had to be paid. And I think that when you really look at the offense that was brought against Dr. Ellsberg, it's hard for me to see how he would have been convicted because I don't think that the espionage case could ever have been made. And even on the theft charge, I think that the evidence was pretty weak. And, of course, when the judge in the Ellsberg-Russo case did learn about the misconduct of the government, that fact, plus other things, led to the dismissal of all charges against Ellsberg. But I never sensed in conversations I had with Mr. Nixon after he resigned that he felt that that Ellsberg was a good person or that he had done the right thing. I never sensed any change of heart there.
How did your association with the Plumbers Unit come to an end?
Well, it came to an end just a few months after the break-in in September, where another leak occurred, and there was a recommendation that had been made to David Young and to me that a wiretap be placed without a warrant on one of the individuals who was a suspect in that other leak. And as I looked at the facts, as I understood them, I just didn't feel that that it deserved a wiretap. And John Ehrlichman, who learned that that David Young and I had a disagreement on that, called me up and he said, well, I think David's right on this, and you're relieved of any more duties with the special investigation unit. David will carry on from here. So as of December of 1971, I had been removed from the plumber's activities.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview our frequent guest host Dave Davies recorded with Eagle Bud Krogh, the first official of the Nixon administration to plead guilty to crimes associated with the Watergate scandal. He headed the secret unit that was known as the Plumbers because it was their job to stop leaks of sensitive information. While Krogh was in charge, the Plumbers broke into the office of Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist after Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon Papers to the New York Times. The illegal activity Krogh was involved in was in 1971, before Nixon's re-election campaign. Krogh has written a new memoir called Integrity.
It was in June of 72, and I think you were in St. Louis, when you read in the newspaper that burglars had been arrested at the Watergate complex. And these folks were pretty quickly tied to the White House. What did you think when you read that news?
Oh, when I first saw that story, I was actually walking through the walkway between the Chase Hotel and the Park Plaza Hotel in St. Louis, and I went up to the news kiosk and I saw the story, and I just stopped and I read it, and it was just my heart just dropped. I said, "Oh no, what have they done?" And then as I read it, and of course as the information came out over the next few days, I realized that Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt had been involved at the committee to reelect and had mounted this operation against the offices of the Democratic National Committee. And I just felt very, very unhappy, deeply unhappy about this, because I sensed that, you know, they had worked for me the year before as part of the Special Investigations Unit, the White House Plumbers, where they had to have gotten the idea that under certain circumstances, the White House would accept covert activity. And then they both of them went to work directly, G. Gordon Liddy for the committee to reelect, and E. Howard Hunt more tangentially, but then they felt that they could move forward with an operation against the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, at the Watergate Hotel Complex in Washington, D.C. And when I saw that story, I just, obviously I put it together and was just deeply distressed by it.
Now, you ended up speaking with John Dean, the counsel to the president, and it seems that he quickly sensed that there would be an ever-widening investigation and that any, you know, improper activities in the administration might come under scrutiny, including the ones you had been involved in the year before. I mean, in effect, you were, at that point, instructed to slam the lid, keep things quiet, right? Make sure you don't talk to anybody.
That's correct. When I came back from my trip to St. Louis, I'd been out there for a couple of weeks, and I met with John, and I could sense that this was a beginning of an effort to sort of keep the lid on the investigation of the Watergate that would lead to other exposures, including the one in 1971, the Plumbers' activities, and basically got from John, who was given, I think, the most thankless job anyone has ever been given in the White House staff, that we were not to disclose those activities, we were not to talk about it, anything that the president had described or defined as a national security issue was not to be discussed. And that's the instruction that I got from John when I came back.
And you were interviewed by attorneys from the Special Prosecutor's Office, right?
Well, this was before the special prosecutor had been set up. At that point, this was in August, the investigation was carried forward by the Office of the U.S. Attorney. Earl Silbert was the U.S. Attorney at that time, and he had assigned one of his assistants to question me about what I knew about Watergate, which was virtually nothing. I mean, I'd read about it in the paper like everybody else did. And when I went into that interview, I had been told beforehand by John Dean that no national security questions would be posed. And in sitting there in that in the room in the Department of Justice, this was not before a grand jury. It was just an interview with an assistant U.S. attorney. It's still a very serious interview, and I was put under oath and was asked a question that I felt basically was going to open up a whole area of national security concerns about the plumbers. And that question was, did I know anything about travel of Mr. Liddy to California? And I believe at that time he had that picture that had been taken by E. Howard Hunt and left in the camera that had gotten to the CIA. And I felt I had sort of three choices that I could say I did not know about any travel, which would have been a false declaration, which it proved to be, or I did know about it, in which case he would have continued to ask questions that would have gotten me into that area, or I could have said I can't answer that question because it's national security, at which point he, the assistant U.S. attorney, can go get the clearance to ask that question, come back, put me under oath again, and require me to answer it, or I would have been ruled in contempt. And I sort of knew what those options were and very unfortunately selected the wrong one. I said I didn't know about that travel. And that ended the inquiry at that point. And I felt impelled to do so because I was sworn to keep those secrets. At least I felt that I was obligated to keep those secrets. But in retrospect, I think everyone would have been much better off if I had been able to and answered truthfully.
The things you were involved in really weren't uncovered for a long time, and you secured an appointment as a Deputy Secretary of Transportation. And then in May 73, you write that the ice cracked open and you fell through. What exactly happened?
Well, in May of 1973, I'd been undersecretary for about 3.5 months. The story about the break-in in 1971 became public. And actually led to the dismissal of charges against Dr. Ellsberg and Tony Russo. And after resigning, I felt I needed to defend myself, which I did. I felt that national security had been the motive for
now,
what we had
just
done.
To be clear, were you charged with a crime at this point?
No, I was not charged with a crime at this point. The indictment against me did not occur until later in the summer of 1973 when I was indicted for false declaration, which was what I had said to the assistant U.S. attorney the year before in August of 1972. So the indictment followed about a year later. Now, once I was indicted, my counsel advised me that, you know, when you go before these different hearings in the Congress or the grand jury, the only course you can take is to plead the Fifth Amendment. That will protect your rights, and then we will be able to litigate this at trial and see if we can make this defense stick. So through the summer and the fall, I did take the Fifth Amendment several times, an excruciatingly difficult thing to do. And then there was a hearing before Judge Gerhard Gesell on a motion that I was entitled not to have to disclose national security information, confidential information, and was entitled to lie if necessary to keep that information from being disclosed.
So you were asserting in a sense that when you had lied to prosecutors earlier that you were engaged in a legitimate defense of national security interests.
Yes. That was the interest, that I had been entrusted with this information. I was not to disclose it under any circumstances, and that would include not disclosing it to an assistant U.S. attorney or to any other body for that matter. And we made that argument before Judge Gesell, who basically shredded it in his response, who said it was just incompatible with our system of law and our system of government, and that had a huge effect on me.
And when did you decide to take a different course and plead guilty?
Well, that hearing before Judge Gesell occurred in October of 1973, and about a month later, over the Thanksgiving holiday of 1973, I took my family down to Williamsburg, Virginia, and I was out with my children and my wife, Suzanne. We were out behind the House of Burgesses, and it was about 4 in the afternoon, and I had been really struggling with what was the right course for me to take. And it was one of those things where I think maybe I'd call it an epiphany. Something very clear came to me, and it was like, now look at this. Your kids are out there playing, and you're able to drive down here on your own recognizance, even though you're under indictment in Washington, D.C. and in California. You're able to talk to reporters. You're able to go to the church of your choice. You have all of these rights that you are exercising right now. What are you defending? Well, it came clear I was defending the right of someone in government under some questionable doctrine of national security to strip away from another American citizen his right to be free from an unwarranted search. How can you defend that and enjoy all these rights without being the ultimate hypocrite? And it just came so clearly, you can't. And then the next thing that came to me was the conduct that you engaged in 1971 strikes at the heart of what this government was designed to protect against, which is the unwarranted intrusion of government into the lives of its citizens. And those two ideas just came to me with such power and clarity. I turned to Suzanne and said, I've got to plead guilty and I've got to do it right away.
And then you take this remarkable course where you meet with the special prosecutors, you enter a guilty plea, and you agree to tell the truth about anything else the government wants you to testify about. But you don't want to testify until after you have been sentenced. Why?
Well, when I went to see Leon Jaworski, who was then the special prosecutor with William Merrill, and my lawyer, Stephen Shulman, a great lawyer, I told the special prosecutor, I said, I want to plead guilty. I think it's the right course, but this will be on the basis that you'll agree that I will be sentenced by a court before I need to speak to a U.S. attorney or the grand jury or anyone else. I said, I can't tolerate the idea of trading testimony for a lighter sentence or having some linkage between the two. And it's just sort of the way that I'm wired, but on the other hand, I would be asked to testify against people who were my friends. And it just didn't seem appropriate to somehow benefit from that. And I didn't know whether Mr. Jaworski would accept the plea under those terms, but he called me back the next day, called actually Steve Shulman back and said that we've agreed to accept Mr. Krogh's plea of guilty and we trust he will tell us the truth, which I did later.
So you were sentenced and served 6 months in prison and were disbarred from the legal profession. And your dad did have to testify against other Watergate figures, including John Ehrlichman, your longtime family friend and father figure. What was that like?
Oh, that was one of the hardest days of my life, was having to go into the courtroom. In the summer of 1974, I had been released from prison. I'd been in both a maximum security jail for a while and then the Allenwood prison camp. Then I had to testify in his trial in the Prettyman Courthouse there in Washington, D.C., and having to sit there in the docket as a witness and testify to acknowledging his signature and what he had written in that memorandum, which basically I think was testimony that helped to convict him, was one of the most difficult things that I've ever had to do in my life. And because I felt tremendously responsible as well for messing up that investigation and putting something at his doorstep that I just wished had not had happened.
Did you talk to Ehrlichman about it afterward? How did he feel about your testifying against him?
Well, I did talk with him about it afterwards. I think he was very disappointed in first of all, how the trial went, because he was obviously convicted, but felt that I had let him down and had let other people down in the way that I had run that operation. And I think in retrospect, that was true. I really did not exercise the degree of wisdom and competence when I ran it. And I think John was pretty clear in letting me know that's what he felt too. So that was one of the hard things, because the families, the Ehrlichman family, the Krogh families, have been very close for a very long time. And interestingly enough, we still are. We're still very close. I mean, my son and John's grandson are very close friends. And so the families had been able to retain the friendship, but John was, I think, deeply disappointed about how the action, first of all, how it went down in 1971, and then when I had to testify against him in 1974.
Well,
very hard thing to do.
I feel like we have to remind the audience that Ehrlichman, in this case, did approve the break-in in writing. I mean, perhaps you could have done differently, but he put his name on that sheet approving a break-in.
Well, and again, just to give him his due on that, he approved a covert operation, and he told me later, he said, I did not envision that covert operation specifically included a break-in. Now, I felt that the words did cover that, and I don't think he ever felt they did. And so we've had that disagreement until he passed on.
You write in this book that the operation which you headed, this unit which broke into Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office, that break-in brought down the Nixon presidency. How do you conclude that?
Well, and I don't think it's a heroic reach of logic, but the way that I see it is that there had been discussion early on in the Nixon administration about illegal operations, burglaries and mail openings and the rest, to respond to what was viewed as a threat from the radical movement in the country. And that was part of something called the Houston Plan in 1970. It had a shelf life of about 5 days. I was aware of that plan. In 1971, that's when the Plumbers Unit is set up to investigate all the aspects of the Pentagon Papers. But the difference there is that an actual break-in, a burglary, occurred. It was something that could not be undone. That was a seminal event in the Nixon administration. 9 months later, the Watergate event occurs, basically engineered and carried out by two people who had worked for the Plumbers Unit in 1971. I don't think that the Watergate event could have occurred if in 1971 we had made clear we're not going to do any kind of covert operation, no illegal operations. Anybody that does this is going to be prosecuted. Because the individuals who went on, E. Howard Hunt and Gordon Liddy, to work for the committee to reelect would not have had that precedent.
You know, and yet, I mean, you know, I understand what you're saying, that once a break-in occurred and was tolerated, you know, more serious violations of law occurred. But I have to note that the guy at the top of this administration, Richard Nixon, says in this conversation, which was recorded on tape, later emerged, and this was in July, I guess, of 71, he is then demanding a break-in at the Brookings Institution. He says, did they get the Brookings Institution raided last night? No, get it done. I want it done. I want the Brookings Institution safe, cleaned out. Wasn't this, with that kind of a mentality at the very top of the White House, wasn't this going to happen anyway?
It may well, Dave, that may well have happened anyway. And that was the tone, that was the attitude, and it was set by the president. I wasn't in that conversation where he gave that order to clean out the safe at the Brookings Institution. And I might say that, you know, John Dean, at great personal risk, shut down that operation in the Brookings Institution. He flew to California and told John Ehrlichman, you can't do this. I mean, something terrible could happen. People can get killed doing something like this, and shut it down. But you're exactly right. The tone was set at the top, and that coursed through all the activities that we carried out. But Richard Nixon did not specifically carry out the actions in 1971, but he did set a tone that allowed them to go forward. I think that's correct.
You have reflected a lot on what integrity in government service means, and that's a theme of this book. And it's interesting that you wrote an open letter to the Bush administration in 2000 about maintaining integrity in public office. Why then? I mean, why not in 1992 or 1988? What made you want to render advice at that point?
Well, I saw the new Bush White House staff get sworn into their jobs in the same room where I'd been sworn in 30 years before. And I knew some of the new staff people, or I knew some of the people who were going into the new Bush administration, Paul O'Neill in Treasury and Don Rumsfeld in the Defense Department. Of course, Dick Cheney was the vice president. And I felt, you know, I'd like to write to that staff a letter, a memorandum that I wished I could have read 33 years before when I was sworn in. So I did. I wrote the memorandum. It was published in the Christian Science Monitor. And what I focused on in that memo was your personal integrity is really the most important thing to maintain. And I described the commissions that they were going to be getting from the president to put on their walls, appointing them to their positions. And the language used is reposing special trust in your integrity. It's their individual integrity, not that of the president or of a senior official. It's theirs. And that if they need to maintain that during the course of their service on the White House staff. And then I gave them some questions to ask. And everything that you are recommending, think it through. Ask the question, is it whole and complete? Have I considered all the consequences I mentioned in the memo Patrick Moynihan, who used to tell us on the White House staff, think everything through before you send a memorandum into the president. And then I said, you know, ask the question, is it right? And those two need to be asked all the time before you make a recommendation and before you make a decision.
How well do you think this administration has gotten it?
Well, I feel that in some areas that that they have not gotten that message, and I was pretty specific in the memo to or advice to lawyers is to use interpretations of the law that are generally well accepted, and not what you can torture meanings like or words like national security and commander in chief into meaning. And I do put out in the book my concern about a memorandum that was written under the auspices of the Office of Legal Counsel and the Department of Justice on the definition of torture and on the authority of the Commander-in-Chief, which, when I read it and my understanding of the law, I felt was fundamentally flawed. It ended up being withdrawn 2 years after it was issued, but it had served as the foundation for the interrogation protocols that eventually were put into effect at Guantanamo Bay and Abu Ghraib. Now, I felt that that was a collapse in integrity, in analytical integrity. And I also mentioned the National Security Agency wiretapping program, where I felt that if they are going to wiretap people, go get the legal authority from Congress. And after 9/11, you know, it's been proven up that they certainly had the ability to get support from Congress for almost any kind of investigative activity that they felt was appropriate. But don't just freelance it and go do it on your own, as we had done in the Plumbers Unit with Richard Nixon. Go get the legal authority to do it. So those, I'm saddened to see those decisions. And there is a stark difference of opinion about what authority the president has under national security crises with this administration than on a lot of other people who have analyzed it.
You know, one of the interesting themes here is the tension between integrity and loyalty. I mean, people get into politics by being loyal to the candidate, loyal to the campaign. And then once in office, you know, are often young people, as you were when you worked at the White House, in you know, important jobs, reporting to important people, and there's a natural tendency to trust their judgment and give them their loyalty. And it's very, very hard, I think, when someone gives you an assignment which is on the edge of integrity, for a young person to say, gosh, I'm not going to do that. You weren't able to do it. How do you empower a younger person to stand up in a situation like that?
Well, I think you need to give them the tools. One of the key points that I try to make in the book is that when you walk into the White House staff or you walk into any government agency or business or profession, you don't check your personal integrity at the door. You need to take that in with you. And you need to be asking key questions repeatedly. It's extremely difficult to... when you are personally loyal to someone, and in my case, with John Ehrlichman, was loyal to him and his family. I'd known him since I was 12 years old. To be able to step outside that and say, wait a second now, is this really consistent with what I feel is the right thing to do? I'm not trying to say that this is easy, because campaigns are run on loyal people who are willing to work absolutely incredible amounts of hours and put in energy to get their candidate elected. But you cannot abandon your own personal sense of what's right and wrong. It's what in the final analysis can keep you safe and make you successful. And unfortunately, you know, young people, it's hard for them just to quit out of opposition. They say, well, I can't go there. There have to be different strategies for how you can stay employed and stay working and still remain true to your own fundamental set of values. And that's what I try to do in the book, is to give some approaches, a model for thinking things through, so people can work effectively, stay loyal to their principle, but also stay loyal to their own personal sense of integrity.
Well, Bud Crowe, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Bud Crowe speaking with our frequent guest host, Dave Davies. Crowe's new memoir is called Integrity.